annals of music history seldom have known a figure as spectacular and predictably unpredictable as George Antheil. Today, his music slowly is making a comeback, although to the general classical music listener, most of Antheil's compositions are forgotten. George Antheil. Here is a man who once drew a pistol during a piano recital to silence a restive audience. A man who, in 1924, composed a piece of music calling for the sounds of three actual airplane propellers. A man who mistakenly was reported by the news media to have been eaten alive by lions in the Sahara Desert. And a man who collaborated with movie actress Hedy Lamarr in the invention and patenting of a World War II torpedo. This year marks the 80th anniversary of the birth of George Antheil. He was born in Trenton, New Jersey, July 8, 1900, the son of a middle-class German-American couple who ran a shoe store, above which the family of six resided. As a young man, Antheil excelled at piano playing, poetry writing, journalism, and boxing. It was perhaps his propensity for fisticuffs which got him expelled from Trenton High School, in fact. But for Antheil, the battle was only beginning. Since the age of 12, he had been composing his own music, and during his late teens, he began commuting to nearby Philadelphia to study composition with Constantine von Sternberg, an elderly man who himself had been tutored by Franz Liszt. At age 19, Antheil began working in New York City with composer Ernest Bloch, who encouraged the young man to leave aside his formerly derivative and academic writing and follow his own personal instincts. Antheil responded by developing what he later called his mechanistic style, boldly rhythmic music incorporating dissonant chords, jazz rhythms, and tone clusters, which shocked audiences wherever he played. By 1922, Antheil had moved to Europe, where soon he became the darling of the artistic left wing. His concerts in Vienna, Budapest, London, and Berlin astounded listeners, who by now were just beginning to accept the music of the French Impressionist composers Debussy and Ravel. Antheil's first home in Europe was Berlin. He lived there for a few months late in 1922 and in early 1923. This was a very important period of maturing for Antheil, the young, apolitical American, thrust into the hard, cold, bitter reality of war-torn Germany. Inflation there was rampant, and women, often from formerly well-to-do families, had become prostitutes in order to raise enough money to feed a ration of bread to their starving children. Antheil, whose concert programs usually included large doses of Debussy and Cyril Scott, recalled that this period cured him of any lingering sentimentality, and he soon thereafter developed a distaste for what he called the fluid, diaphanous lechery of the Impressionists. Reflective of the realities of post-war Europe, the cold, hard new music of Stravinsky became his ideal, and since Stravinsky was spending a few months in Berlin, waiting for his mother to join him from the Soviet Union, Stravinsky and Antheil spent many long days together in conversation. In his autobiography, Bad Boy of Music, which in the spring of 1981 will be reissued by Da Capo Press, Antheil recalls an incident he experienced with Stravinsky. "One night we decided to walk home instead of taking a cab. It was rather late to be taking a walk, and dangerous, too, for it was well past midnight. Berlin was full of thugs, also full of streetwalkers. We went through the famous Brandenburg Gate. When we got out on the Tiergartenallee Strasse, we saw about 50 girls running towards us, and they surrounded us. I guess that nobody except Frank Sinatra ever had such a strange feeling. But the girls who surround Frank Sinatra are nice little girls, whereas the girls who surrounded us that night were very bad little girls indeed. At least I'm afraid that the Ladies Contemporary Club of Trenton, New Jersey would think so. I would not have known how to get out of such a jam, but Stravinsky was about 20 years older than I, and he knew. He spoke to the girls, calmed them down. He said that we'd just come from entertaining 6 girls, 3 apiece, and that we were really very, very tired. They would, he felt sure, understand. They did. They broke up and left us. Professional etiquette. By June of 1923, George Antheil had moved to Paris with his new girlfriend, Breski Marcus, a Hungarian revolutionary who had fled her well-to-do family in Budapest and still was mildly suspicious of her new American capitalist boyfriend. The couple took an apartment at 12 Rue de l'Odéon, just above the American bookstore Shakespeare and Company, run by Sylvia Beach. After Antheil's first solo concert in Paris that October, all of the literary set who visited Beach's bookstore wanted as well to meet the fiery little American whose piano music had caused a riot in the Champs-Élysées Theater. Antheil wrote about that first concert, "From October 4th, 1923, everybody in Paris knew who I was. I represented the anti-expressive, anti-romantic, coldly mechanistic aesthetic of the early 20s. Among Antheil's champions were Man Ray, Pablo Picasso, Fernand Léger, James Joyce, Eric Satie, Marcel Duchamp, and, most importantly, Ezra Pound, the American poet from Haley, Idaho. Pound even wrote a book called Antheil and the Treatise on Harmony, in which he touted Antheil as the most important living composer, more progressive in theory and practice than even Stravinsky or Schoenberg. As an example of the esteem in which Antheil's piano playing was held, let me quote from a book by the pianist Oscar Levant. It was written in 1940 and titled A Smattering of Ignorance. Levant writes, "Considering that I am a person who lacks no possible human failing, I've been constantly amazed by Copland's generosity. Encountering a particular example of it one day, I said to him in wonder and curiosity, 'Weren't you ever jealous of anyone?' His reply was, 'When I first went to Paris, I was jealous of Antheil's piano playing. It was so brilliant. He could demonstrate so well what he wanted to do.'" We can safely say that from 1923 to 1926, George Antheil was, internationally, the most famous living American composer writing music of any modernistic persuasion. As Copland recently told me, "George had Paris by the ear." In 1924, Antheil, still living in Paris, wrote the piece for which he is best remembered. This was the Ballet Mécanique, originally intended for 16 synchronized player pianos as an accompaniment for a film by Fernand Léger. The film, now remembered as one of the first abstract motion pictures, has become a classic of the Dada surrealist period. Antheil's music was composed originally for piano 4 hands to be cut onto player piano rolls by the French manufacturer Pleyel. This was done, but the problem of synchronizing the 16 pianolas by means of a single switchboard never was managed. Furthermore, there was no manner in 1924 of putting sound on film, so the idea of synchronizing the film and the music was dropped. Each piece, the film and the music, became separate entities. Later that year, Antheil reworked the original idea, scoring the Ballet Mécanique now for 1 player piano, 8 regular grand pianos played by 8 pianists, 3 keyboard-operated xylophones, 2 electric doorbells, 1 metal and 2 wooden airplane propellers, tam-tam, 4 bass drums, and siren. The work was given its first performance in Paris in the year 1926. It was, to put it mildly, a sensation. Thank you. In the spring of 1927, Antheil was invited to America for a triumphant return. News of his success in Paris had reached these shores, and he was anxious to show American music audiences just how modern music really could be. Antheil still remembered the terrifically conservative atmosphere which dominated American musical life when he'd left the country in 1922. Small inroads had been made since that time through concerts given by such composers as Edgar Varèse and Carlos Salcedo. Nevertheless, these had had little impact on the larger concert-going audience. But on April 10, 1927, 3,000 people turned out to Carnegie Hall to witness an all-Antheil concert featuring the Ballet Mécanique. Unfortunately for Antheil, his publicity work was done by a book promoter who took rather great liberties with his job. The pre-concert announcements in the press promised nothing less than the Second Coming, an evening which would blow the hats off of the musical public with sounds equal to and exceeding those of a building demolition crew. Antheil himself had been convinced by the promoters to double the number of grand pianos to 16 and to utilize a giant propeller, which was a visual object only. The real propeller sounds that night were made by a small airplane motor. Also, the promoter had spent much of his budget on a garish curtain, a tasteless backdrop portraying a jazz-crazy 1927 America, which, according to Antheil, gave an air of complete charlatanism to the whole proceedings. And doubling the number of pianos considerably diluted the sharp tone quality Antheil had wanted. Clearly, the audience was disappointed as well. Also played on that all-Antheil concert, but scarcely noticed because of the anticipation of the Ballet Mécanique, were three other works. There was the Sonata No. 2 for violin, piano, and drums, commissioned in Paris by Ezra Pound for his friend, violinist Olga Rudge, who had premiered it. The String Quartet No. 1, and Antheil's Jazz Sinfonietta. The Jazz Symphony, as it has come to be known, originally was written in response to a request from the Paul Whiteman Orchestra, but when Whiteman saw the score, he rejected it as too raw and experimental. So the first performance ever given of the Jazz Symphony was done by the W.C. Handy Orchestra at this Carnegie Hall concert of 1927. Since it was poorly received by the audience, Antheil put it away on his shelf, and the work was not played again until he revised it slightly in 1955. Bischke Antheil, the composer's widow, recalled that Handy himself, the bandleader, was unable to read music, but disguised this by pretending to have forgotten his glasses during each of the rehearsals. Finally, another player who could read replaced him. Antheil himself wrote in Bad Boy of Music, his 1945 autobiography, "During the many rehearsals of this work, I'd gotten to know and admire many of the Negro orchestra men, so I now gave them box seats in foremost sections of Carnegie Hall, which on concert night they filled with their wives and relatives, one of the truly nice things I still remember about that otherwise most depressing concert." The music of the Jazz Symphony is written in such a way that the audience hears a wild procession of musical quotations, but spliced together in sequence like images in a surrealist film. The quotations remind one of the style of Charles Ives, but Ives's music was totally unknown to Antheil, if not most everyone at that time. Now, in the 70s and 80s, the Jazz Symphony frequently appears on orchestral concert programs both in Europe and here in America. The revival of interest in the piece is due to the work of the Dutch composer and conductor Reinbert de Leeuw. His performances of the Ballet Mécanique and the Jazz Symphony at the Holland Festival in 1976 caused an international sensation. You've heard part one of a two-part feature on the life and music of the American composer George Antheil. On the second part, we'll hear the voice of Antheil himself, recorded on a Hollywood radio program in the early 1950s. For Pacifica Radio, this is Charles Amerikanian. To conclude our short history of the life of George Antheil, we begin with an interview recorded in the Netherlands with conductor Reinbert de Leeuw, who in 1976 at the Holland Festival led successful performances of Antheil's Ballet Mécanique and Jazz Symphony. His dynamic readings of these pieces with the Netherlands Wind Ensemble created a sensation. What was Antheil doing in this piece that's so interesting?
Now, he did, in a very radical way, he dealt with some things you can compare with what's in literature and in the sculpture. In the 20s, people like Marcel Duchamp and the Dada and Surrealist, that's extreme radicalism, what isn't the music. Perhaps it was in Russia also in that time, I don't know, because it is all buried in the... you can know it now. But there is something in the way he was dealing with that, in radicalism, that is completely unique. If you compare this piece, the Ballet Mécanique, with Lenas of Stravinsky, and you compare the Jazz Symphony with Création du Monde of Milo, you can compare them. And you see the difference between making art just in a traditional way, the way Milo and Stravinsky were doing it, and his way, he was just going through barriers and going further.
Reinbert de Leeuw conducting the Ballet Mécanique at the 1976 Holland Festival. Could you talk a bit about the Jazz Symphony? What is this piece exactly?
Yeah, it is an extraordinary piece. I can only compare it with a Dutch composer who is living now and whose name is Willem Breuker. And he is, his background is not the traditional background, but he's originally a jazz musician. And he makes music who is between everything. You can't say it is jazz, it is not classical, traditional, it is just something new. But this part in it were coming from jazz music. And I think Antheil, when he wrote this piece, completely different again with Milo, for instance, didn't try to collect some jazzy things into music and to just use some jazzy materials like Milo or Stravinsky did, but to try to the directness and the rawness of the playing, the way of playing of the jazz orchestras in that time, to make their a piece on it. And I think that is the quality of the piece.
Reinbert de Leeuw concluding that Antheil's Jazz Symphony is closer to real Harlem jazz than works of the other classical European composers who imitated it in their own works. That would include composers like Ravel, Mio, and Stravinsky. After his Quicksilver successes in Paris, Antheil moved on to Austria and Germany, where he began his career as an opera composer. But the coming to power of Hitler forced him and his wife Beschke to move back to the States. George supported his family for the last 23 years of his short life by writing Hollywood film scores. With the death of Beschke in 1978, his last direct descendant is his son Peter, who still lives in Los Angeles, where next Monday evening at the Los Angeles County Museum of Art, he will attend a concert dedicated to the 80th birthdays of both Aaron Copland and George Antile. Lots of the fascinating events of Antile's life certainly are extra musical. He authored a book on glandular criminology, another predicting almost perfectly the outcome of World War II, but written in 1940, and he developed and patented a radio-directed torpedo in collaboration with actress Hedy Lamarr, who had been married at one time to a German ballistics expert. All of this and much more is documented in his fascinating autobiography. Antile's music after the 20s resembled more the styles developed by Prokofiev, Shostakovich, and Benjamin Britten. His Fourth Symphony was premiered by Stokowski in 1944, his Fifth by Ormandy in 1947, and the Sixth Symphony, commissioned by Pierre Monteux, and the San Francisco Symphony was premiered here in 1949. In 1958, Antile moved to New York to work on the music for the CBS television series The 20th Century, hosted by Walter Cronkite. He was by then bitterly disappointed by the rejection which was shown him by other serious composers after he worked in Hollywood. For all the while, he was writing concert music, which today sounds more substantial than that of many others who at the time were more often performed. He died in New York on February 12, 1959, of heart failure, brought on by overwork and exhaustion. He was just 58 years old. His work on Hollywood film scores might not have been the only reason Antile was looked upon with suspicion. The issuing of Bad Boy of Music in 1945 set off a storm of controversy, not unlike the more recent diary books by composer Ned Roram. Antile's writing was frank and direct. He told his life as he had remembered it, using the names of many people who might have wished to have remained anonymous. This is Antile's assessment of the book, recorded on a Hollywood radio show sometime around the early 1950s.
So by 1933, when Hitler actually came to power, I came back to America and sort of started all over again. I lived in New York. I worked with Balanchine. I did some ballets for him, and it was a very wonderful experience because Balanchine is certainly one of the greatest men of the ballet, and it was a wonderful experience to work so closely with him. And some of the things I've said in my book, Bad Boy of Music, concerning his choosing me because I was sort of halfway in between Paris, where I'd lived, and America, are rather unjust, I think. In fact, I advise no one to write a book of memoirs until they are at least 60 or 70. Bad Boy of Music, which is a book that I wrote, I oftentimes regret extremely, because lots of things I didn't remember correctly. Some things I remembered too correctly. Just a little bit of advice, don't write a book. If you're a composer, write music. I sort of got into motion pictures with Ben Hecht and did some of those pictures that he and Charles MacArthur produced in Astoria, Long Island, amongst them being Once in the Blue Moon, The Scoundrel. And this gave me just enough of a taste for motion picture scoring to come out here to Hollywood, where I did it. My first picture was for C.B. DeMille. I think that was in 1936, and it was called The Plainsman. And this started me off here. And I have discovered that by writing one or two scores a year that I can live fairly comfortably and have 9 or 10 months a year to compose in. Of course, New York composers are horrified by my coming out here because they think I'm jumping in and out of swimming pools with Hedy Lamarr and motion picture actresses. But actually, I live a very sedate home life. My pupils come here, one or two. And we live a sort of what you might call a string quartet sort of life. Chamber music, analysis of symphonies, composing, operas. I mean, the house is full of music. And once or twice a year, I go into, I pick up my courage and I go to the studios. And where I work exactly as I would work home. I write the same sort of music. And I think this is rather unjust of anyone to think that one is being corrupted by Hollywood. And I'm trying to corrupt Hollywood in a good way. And I hope to get some credit for it, probably posthumously.
George Antheil at the piano in one of his set of Valentine waltzes composed in 1949. The music of George Antheil, much written about in histories of 20th century music, now is finding its way into our concert halls once again. The brash young kid from Trenton, who would have been 80 today, can rest assured that his work, though temporarily in eclipse, once again is finding its audience because of its inherent vitality and exuberance. Tonight's West Coast premiere of Antheil's Jazz Symphony with Maestro Edo DeVart, leading members of the San Francisco Symphony Orchestra, is another step on the way to the reinstatement of one of our most original and provocative lights in 20th century American music. And so, with this theme music by George Antheil for the Walter Cronkite CBS television series, The 20th Century, we close this brief summary of the composer's life. The technical producer for this feature was Warren Van Orden. For Pacifica Radio in Berkeley, KPFA, this is Charles Amerikanian.